And I'm Allie.
And it's
About Time for True Crime.
Hi.
Hey.
How are you?
How are you?
I am great. Killing it, crushing it, living it, loving it. Living, I'm loving, I'm picking it up, you know?
Sure, yeah.
How about you?
We are in the first week of August, so I am about a month out from my wedding, so I am, how you say, stressing.
Yeah.
But other than that, things are good. It's not stressing like it's bad. Stressing like, oh my God, there's still so much to do for a wedding.
Yes.
It's stress. It's a trap. It's a trap, okay?
Yeah, it is. It's all a trap.
But I'm very excited.
An exciting, lovely, romantic, beautiful trap.
Oh, I'm over the moon. I'm very much excited, but it's such a Hallmark ordeal.
That it is.
Like, I just want to marry the man.
Yeah.
But after it's done, or the day of, and after it's done, I will be so thankful that I did all of the things.
Yes.
All of the things.
Even the day before.
Yes.
Because I'm the best in not letting you worry about anything the day before.
So. I know. I'm very lucky to have a great maid of honor. What can I say?
Well, I won't disagree. No, I'm kidding.
You shouldn't.
Ugh. You guys are too nice to me. Both Allie and her mom, when we like will go places, they'll be like, we have the best maid of honor. I was like, I don't do anything. I just hang out. I just hang out and vibe.
No.
And give you compliments on that fat ass.
No, you do amazing things. You made an incredible bachelorette party.
That was fun.
Yes, I know. See, you just have fun doing all of the things that stress me out.
Oh, okay.
Like, what you call fun is what I call stressful.
What I call fun, my therapist calls OCD tendencies. So.
Well, tomato, tomato.
No, it is fun. It's good. And it's nice to get to celebrate you. You get married once, but I only get to be your maid of honor once. So.
You can make me cry.
Well, okay. That's not true. If your fiance doesn't play his cards right, I'll get to be your maid of honor more than once. But I'll be the only one you have. You know?
True.
And this is the only time I get to do it for the first time.
But he's going to be on his best behavior.
He better be.
For the rest of forever.
I told him that I'd be at every wedding you had.
But he wouldn't.
I can't say the same for sure. Hopefully.
God, that'd be so... No.
Imagine being like, I'll be there.
Well, he is. He's going to be at all my weddings because there's going to be one.
Yep.
And he's going to be crying.
Oh my gosh, what a baby.
I can't wait. He is such a stoic man. Like, he doesn't get emotional. He doesn't really.
No.
He is cool, calm, collected, but when it comes to me, he cries and I'm going to give him shit.
Yep. And you deserve both on your wedding day.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, that's kind of life here. We're just chugging.
And it's National Night Out. We talked about that last week. So, if you're listening to this on drop day, happy National Night Out.
Woo! Yeah, go check it out. See what's around you. See what's in your area.
Go learn about your resources and tell a friend.
Or bring one.
Heck yeah.
Or both.
Yeah.
And then they tell two friends. And then
they tell two friends.
And then they tell two.
And then from the top down, and then everyone spends money, and then we're all rich. Do you see how it goes?
And then Keith Raniere gets all of the money, right?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. No, I finally understand Nexium.
Yep. Now you get it. It's almost like it took, what, 5 parts?
Yeah, pretty
much.
Of a
series to... I knew you'd get there eventually.
Eventually, but...
What do you have for me today?
I would like to say hello and hi and welcome everyone to or back to their favorite true crime podcast, About Time for True Crime.
Guys.
So sweet. Please remember to follow, like, leave us a 5-star review and interact with our episodes or posts to best help the pod if you like what you hear. These actions are the best to encourage us and the algorithms to help us keep putting more stuff out for you.
Yeah.
Now, I do, of course, want to start with my sources and trigger warnings because I'll get into what I'm talking about soon, but also my sources kind of give it away. So, I took a lot in sources from the Matthew Shepard Foundation, as well as YoFile, BBC, LA Times, NBC, and more. I will give a huge, giant shout out to the movie Matthew Shepard is a Friend of Mine, as well as the podcast You're Wrong About that did a phenomenal episode on this. And I listened to Morbid's 2-part series on the case, which was great for the actual case facts.
Oh my God, I think I know this one.
Four trigger warnings. There will be a lot today. Today's case includes brutal attacks, hate crimes, humiliation, violence, closeted and uncloseted queerness as the overall arching rainbow, suicidal ideation, and a lot of political noise. I won't dip too much into politics, but it is relevant at the end. I wanted to start today's episode by asking you a simple question. What is a sacrifice? Sure, there are a few ways to interpret it. There's the biblical sense, which is usually killing or giving something up that you value or prize. Biblically, specifically, is kind of like people would sacrifice their best sheep or the best of their crop to their deity for good favor. Sacrifices can also be made in wars and in battles like chess, where you might intentionally sacrifice something in a moment, knowing it will later lead to a good or benefit outcome. I don't think a sacrifice is what happens, though, when somebody dies and the world propels forward. In my opinion, sacrifices only count if you're willing to give something up, if you do it knowingly. Otherwise, it's a casualty and the rest of us got lucky. Today's case was not a sacrifice made by anyone. Today's case is the brutal murder of a young man fueled largely in part or entirely by hatred for his sexual orientation. I know I get caught up in semantics, but I think words are important. We assign meaning for a reason, and if we can't communicate with them, there's no reason to have them. It pains me to hear when people call Matthew Shepard's death a sacrifice, because the victim here didn't die for you. He didn't die for me, and he didn't die for a political advantage. The perpetrators didn't make a decision to end this man's life for the betterment of others or to please a higher power. This was just murder. And if we have to take something away from it, I'm glad there's a thick silver lining. But inside that lining, there's still a funnel cloud just tempting to touch down over and over again still to this day. So let this be a warning. Today we are talking about Matthew Shepard, a man who made no sacrifice but died. And his victimization largely did positively impact the world, but not because he wanted it to. So that's where we're starting. Let me take you back to Casper, Wyoming, though. It's 1976. In fact, it's December 1st, 1976. It was a cold day, a high of 32 degrees Fahrenheit, a low of 8, 7.9 if you want to get specific. It was cloudy and freezing when Matthew Wayne Shepard was born into this world to his parents, Judy and Dennis Shepard. Matt, as his friends called him, had a happy childhood. He was well-loved, and he loved well right back. 5 years later, in 1981, Matt gained a little brother, Logan, before going off to school. Logan and Matt were complete opposites. It's very cute. Matt was short and blonde and nerdy and like very politically minded, and he loved people. Logan was tall and athletic and hated being around people. They were just 180s, but they were so close. And it's really cute. I'm going to ask you guys at the end of this to go and watch that documentary that one of his friends made called Matthew Shepard is a Friend of Mine. There's like home videos in it from his childhood, and it's like his little brother just doing little brother things. Like, he showed a little picture of Matt at one point, and he was like, "That's my older brother. He's coming home today. He's awesome." And like, aww, he's running around. There's videos of Matt on the couch, like watching TV, and he's like, "No, like, get the camera out of my face." It's cute. Like, they're just brothers. They just grew up together and they were close and sweet. Like, there was nothing sinister there at all.
And home videos are supposed to be something that they could have watched with their own families later on.
Right. And say, remember that?
And not be this sort of haunting what could have been.
I shouldn't have to see another family's home videos without them asking, "Hey, this is so funny. Do you want to see this?" You know, it sucks. But soon after, Matt went to Crest Hill Elementary School before going on to Dean Morgan Junior High, and later, I think it's called Natrona County High School, in his sophomore year. Despite some teasing due to his small stature and his lack of athleticism, I'll say, as a fellow non-athlete.
Retweet.
By all accounts, Matt really liked his childhood. His favorite Halloween costume was Dolly Parton, who he went as many times. And his mom, Judy, says he didn't always wait to Halloween to practice. He even became interested in politics at a very young age and was so excited about it. He'd read newspapers and he could keep up with adults on current events. He said when he grew up, he wanted to be a diplomat and make change and help people. That's all he ever wanted to do was help people. Matt's friends call him tender-hearted and kind. He was interested in drama and artistic expression. And another one of those fun little anecdotes from his childhood from his mom was that he used to write poems and put them in his neighbor's mailboxes. But I guess his grandfather or another member of his family was like a, I don't know if he was a post office like delivery man or if he had some other thing, but he was like, hey kid, like you have to put a stamp on that or that's illegal.
Oh,
so Matt stopped and instead started picking up rocks that he thought were cool in the neighborhood, and he'd put those in the mailboxes instead, thinking that it would make the neighbors happy that someone thought of them.
What a sweet boy.
He is the kind of guy that I know for a fact I would have been friends with had we crossed paths.
Most definitely.
He was always a giver, and he always wanted to help any way that he could. Matt was fearless also, though. According to his mom, Judy, he was not shy. Despite being 5'2 and probably a 120 soaking wet, Matt would step into the middle of any injustice to try to help someone out. He was sure in who he was, and he was sure that people deserved good things. In the summer of 1993, Dennis, Matt's dad, got hired by Saudi Aramco, which is an oil-based company in Saudi Arabia. Matt's family packed up, left Casper, Wyoming for the first time in his 16 years at that point, and moved to Saudi Arabia.
Oh, geez.
Matt was really excited. His family wanted him to see the world beyond the United States and beyond small-town Wyoming. Plus, Matt's dreams kind of went hand in hand with that. He wanted to do much bigger things than Casper, Wyoming. Not that that's not important in its own right, but he just had big dreams.
He wanted to be worldly. He was going to see the world. Okay.
Yeah. And he did. He went. And they wanted to send him to high school there. But at the time, there were no American high schools in Saudi Arabia. So he actually got to go to a boarding school in Switzerland that he loved. This was a huge move. And Matt's family lived in a company-owned building in, I think it's called Duran or Darin, I'm not sure. Matt was able to go to the American school in Switzerland. I think it's actually pronounced TASIS, or like that's the abbreviation that people call it. And he learned to travel. He learned three languages. He graduated in 1995, and he had the time of his fucking life. He told his mom that he had some of the best experiences of his life, and he met people that he was sure were going to be some of the most important people he'd ever meet.
Aww.
Two major events of note happened in 1995 and 1996, though. The first was terrible, and a giant, fat, big, soaking trigger warning here for violence and rape.
So this was, he was born in 76, you said?
Yes.
So he's about 1920-ish when this is what we're talking about? Because you said 96? 95 and 96?
This one's 95. I think he's still 18.
Okay.
So before his birthday, before he graduates, there was a school trip to Morocco.
Okay.
He was abroad and he got to study abroad from being abroad, which is fucking badass.
That is so cool.
And he was so excited because they all wanted to go and see new things and new cultures. And of course, at this point, I mean, Matt's seen Western culture. His family lives in Saudi Arabia, and now he's in Europe. So, like, he's got quite a few down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, yeah, let's go on a class trip here. And all of his friends are going. Of course he's going to want to go.
Right. So he's down. And a trip that was supposed to be fun and exciting ended up terribly. Matt and his friends tried really hard to be safe at the time. And I won't speak for currently, but certainly at the time, it was not a very safe place for American teenagers to be. So they all went out in pairs. They all did things in groups. They were at like a, I assume, like a tourist spot where people were staying.
Mm-hmm.
But Matt went out one night, for better or worse judgment. I don't know. I wasn't there. I don't know the full climate. But he went out to just take a walk and clear his head. And it wasn't going to be long. It wasn't even that late. But on his way home, he was actually pulled into an alley by a local gang who robbed him, beat him, and gang raped him 6 times.
Oh, my goodness.
Matt returned to the hotel that all the kids were at, and he was just pounding on his friend's doors, screaming and sobbing, explaining what had happened.
And what do you do when you're in a country that you don't know, you don't speak the language, you don't know how their system works, you don't know if that's mm-hmm. acceptable, you don't know what, that's not what you're used to.
No, and I mean, fuck, dude, 6 people.
And you're terrified, you don't know if they followed you, you don't know what happened.
And you're 16. Mm. Well, okay, at max, 18. You still know nothing about how those things work on your own without guidance, you know? And that's even in your own country. So it was just awful. Of course, nobody can really confirm the motive of this, although it is believed that it's because he was seemingly outwardly a little more flamboyant. Or maybe it's just because he was small and an easy target. I don't know. But he did report it to the cops. There was never any follow-up as to whether or not it was actually seen through over there. So I don't know if that's because he never received follow-up or if because what happens to Matt later just shadows this so much.
Well, yeah, and they probably would need him there.
Right.
As part of the process of if they were going to move forward with it, if they even could. And what's he going to do, fly back out? I mean, he certainly could.
Yeah.
But then that's more terrifying, more funds that he now has to pay. He's going to miss school to, you know.
Right.
Not to say that it doesn't and can't happen, but this you've added so much more strain and barriers for him to be able to find justice in this now.
Yeah. And so it was just awful. He came back and he suffered as anybody would. That is insane trauma. That is like all caps trauma, not even just capital T. Like, And Matt came back with life-changing depression, PTSD, and panic attacks. Judy, his mom, said that he was never the same after Morocco, and neither were we. We were always concerned for his physical safety and his mental state after that.
And they knew what happened to him?
Yeah, he came back and he told them. Another event, though, that happened shortly thereafter, which is cause for celebration, so it's good, we get a little relief, was that Matt came out as gay. And I'm going to talk about gayness and queerness a lot in this episode. I will refer to queerness as the LGBTQIA2S+. I think I got all of those right. I'm trying to keep up. I'm one of you. There's so many. So I will just refer to it as queer or queerness if it's everybody in that alphabet soup. And Matt specifically was gay, though. So Matt came out as gay to his mom. And while I don't know for a fact when it happened this year, I know that it went well. Coming out is terrifying for anyone, especially in the cultural climate Matt was in typically out west with his family in rural places. But then after they moved, it was also nerve-wracking because his family was Episcopalian. They had a deep love for church, and Matt did specifically as well. He loved church and God. He was an altar boy as a kid, and as a fellow queer person who grew up in the church, it adds a layer of complications in accepting yourself and feeling confident that your loved ones will love you afterwards. It's kind of like toothpaste. You can squeeze it out, but even if you can get any part of it back in, it's not going to look anywhere near the same. It's just a mess. And hopefully you get a good response, but if you don't, you can't take it back. It's done. And so you kind of have to live with this permanency of this moment. And so for Matt, it took a long time. Judy says she was pretty sure he was gay by the time he was like 8. And she said that, you know, she never said anything or made it an issue or a problem for him to come to her about. She just kind of let it be. But she was pretty sure. She was so funny. She was making me laugh in her interview where she was talking about his Dolly Parton costume. She was like, I don't know if that's stereotypical to say. But it's what started making me think.
Like, yeah, she's like that kind of.
She was like Dolly Parton at 8.
Gave me the
in
hint.
August. Okay, good.
And when he told me he was gay, yeah, it made sense.
Yeah. So while I wasn't there, the accounts I heard suggested it was a very positive response from his family. Matt told his mom first, who said something along the lines of, okay, I love you and I want you to be happy and healthy. And that's it. Like, we love you exactly as you are. You're our son no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Which, frankly, I wish was the story for absolutely everybody who
came
out. Yeah,
that's exactly how it should be.
Matt did ask her not to tell his dad, but only because he wanted to tell him. He was like, I want to be the one to tell him. Like, can you let me? Mm-hmm. And she makes me laugh because she was like, I promised and then I immediately told him. She was like, I didn't want to lie, but I kind of wanted to protect their relationship in that sometimes when you find out shocking news, you react. You don't respond.
Mm-hmm.
And she said she wanted to give her husband and her son the benefit of the response and not the reaction.
That's a mom.
So she did this. And later when Matt told his dad, he was like, Dad, I have something really important to tell you. I'm gay. And his dad has like one of my favorite responses to this, which was, it's along the lines of this. All right. Like, okay, cool. I love you. I'm proud of you. You're my son. No matter what. What was the important thing?
Oh,
and like, I just, that warms my heart. I love that because that's really all it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't have to be anything deeper than that. Doesn't have to be bigger or smaller, but that's all it was for them. You're my son. You love who you love. We love you. So we'll love them too.
That's it.
I know his family loved him and encouraged him to go where he belonged. They wanted him to find a safe community. And I consider that a win, especially because there's this gray area when you come out, regardless of the reception. If it's good, there's kind of two options. And I guess there's more than that. But the two that come to mind are, we accept you, but that's the end of our involvement with this piece of your life until you bring someone home, which isn't inherently wrong. But there's also what his family did, which I really like, which was, we love you and we know this might make your life harder, so let's talk about how to keep you safe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also important. Being queer is nowhere near the same thing as being a person of color or a minority in a way that is significantly more visible. There are queer-coded people that get treated a lot similarly because it's more obvious, but it's not quite the same amount of transparency in what's happening. And for Matt, in the 1990s, it was still a very, very rocky time to be out and open, even if it wasn't being persecuted. So for his parents to do this, to sit down and say, hey, like, this might cause issues. How are we going to keep you safe and happy at the same time? I think was really advanced. I know that I've heard of families of color talking about this in their life and just what it's like to live in a world with racism. And so I think that it was very nuanced and advanced for his family to take this approach. We'll circle back to this in a minute, but before we move too far on, I do want to talk about Matt's mental health, because obviously this was a phenomenal moment in his life, but this came after one of the most horrific traumas that he faced.
Which probably also made him question his sexuality too, in a way where the trauma that he faced was sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And he's coming out with this part of his life. And anytime those two things sort of like overlap, there's confusion.
Yeah.
There's confusion regardless. Gay, straight, whatever it is. Now this is a part of your life that you want to enjoy, but there's also pain.
Response.
Yeah. There's mental and emotional pain associated with that.
Right.
And that's going to make it harder for you to physically do, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Now you have this to work through.
Now you have sexual assault trauma anytime you want to experiment or anytime you want to see if you like that thing that you are going to have to get past mentally. And it sucks.
Which is regardless of who you want to be with. But now,
right,
you have to unpack that almost before or alongside figuring out this new piece of your life or moving forward with it or being more open with it. And that is,
yeah,
that's a lot. And that's a lot for a young person to deal with.
Yes, it's a lot for anyone, and especially someone who, you know, as a society, we largely still say gay. And I will bring up the slur later. So I'll give you a trigger warning before we do that. But we say all of these things in such negative connotations. And at the time, it was even worse. And I feel so badly for the men in our country and the toxic masculinity that has like seeped its way into their little brains, like the viruses and the ants and the nature docs where they like grow out of their head, you know?
Ew.
That's what it feels like to me, because men, in my opinion, have been raised without the same cushion that women have of the emotional intelligence and being able to talk about their feelings. And when women got that, you can do anything, be who you want to be. Men didn't get the same treatment with emotional intelligence. So now it's just, I have these feelings. I can't talk about them. I can't show them. I am queer, which is absolutely not accepted in this society. People think they're going to catch it from me still. We're still in the wake of AIDS, which is a horrendous period in queer history in and of itself. And now you have to do all of that, work through sexual assault trauma, and do it abroad.
Yeah, no way.
And then leave your family and everyone else to go to college.
Mm-mm-mm.
Matt's mental health worsened, to say the least, after this trauma in Morocco. He became paranoid of people, and then he would counter that paranoia by like almost trusting too much. And I completely understand this. The way that trauma responds in your brain, it's like, oh, okay, I can't go there because this traumatic thing happened and now I'm afraid to do this thing. And then you think back to yourself and you're like, no, fuck that. I'm going to do what I want. Like, this shouldn't control me.
So and then you like overdo it too far.
Yes. And so his pendulum is just going back and fucking forth. Like,
yeah,
there's no middle ground. But it's the 90s. Some things are a little more common. Like he, I think, got some rides home with strangers from bars before, and that worked out. Like,
which is certainly less common in 2024.
Certainly less common and risky.
Mm-hmm.
I understand why. You're living in a time where the world is small enough that your neighbor should be able to drive you home. That doesn't mean that's the reality of the situation.
Right.
But largely it worked out for him for a long time. And he'd walk alone at night. He'd go out to clubs. And he'd really try not to let this fear of what happened cripple his functioning. But like we just said, it's that pendulum. It would in either extreme. Matt was a hesitant dater, as most young queer people are, especially in areas where it's not widely accepted, like, I don't know, rural Western towns or Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That'll do it.
Matt was not shy as a person, but he was certainly not putting this out there for everyone to know, even though he came out to his parents. It took a long time for him to do that. I think the first person he ever came out to was his guidance counselor at his first high school in Wyoming. And his name is Walt. He actually comes up later and he's a great guy, but he completely understood. He was like, by the time Matt left, he was just getting comfortable with some people that I think he might have told. And then you have to start all over again.
Yep.
He tells his parents, and then you go to college and you start all over again. So he never really had a long enough time to get confident that he could be who he was publicly.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that doesn't always mean that you don't present yourself certain ways. But Matt's family said that where he used to be confident and held his head up high and outgoing, after Morocco, he took on the stance of a victim. He sort of curled into himself, which is awful to hear, because you know exactly what that kid's like. His shoulders are slumped, his head's down.
You've seen that kid.
And that's not Matt.
Mm-hmm.
Matt only had one serious relationship, and this was during his first few years outside of high school. So from the years of like 1996 to 1998, Matt was kind of in and out of different places. He started at a few different colleges to go to school, and then either his mental health would worsen and he would go home, or he would have a mental health flare up and his grades would suffer. He had really bad ADHD that he always struggled with, so his parents were always worried that if he had like a few weeks or a week or two out of school from his mental health, that he was not going to be able to recover from it.
Mm.
And I know that happened at least one school. And I know again later he did have a few hospitalizations for some suicidal ideation. He was going through it. In that time, Matt only had one serious relationship, and that was with a man who, according to hints I got from friends and family, seemed at least verbally abusive. His parents noted, or at least his mom did, that his first boyfriend hurt him over and over again, and his friends said similar things that made me think maybe not physical, but certainly some way. Matt, I'm sure in part due to the hospitalizations, had been set up with a psychiatrist and had been on a medication regimen for daily and as needed medications. Actually, fun fact, Matt and I both took the pill Effexor for a long time.
Cool girl.
Hashtag anxiety gang. But Matt went on to college, trying to live as normally as he could with all of the demons he was fighting. He wanted to try basically like one last time. Like, let's give it the real college try. So before he left his parents' house where he was staying, and I believe they were still in Saudi Arabia at the time, Matt and his family came up with a plan. They wanted to find a good school for him. They thought that he had a good hold on his mental health, and they really wanted to give it one more go at a place they felt safe with him being there.
Okay.
And they went back to Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
Not the whole family, but I think the three of them sort of decided together that the University of Wyoming would be a great spot for him. In part because he knew where it was. It was close to where he had grown up. And that's kind of a homey feel, right?
Yeah, maybe some high school friends even went there. So maybe you have some familiar faces too.
Right. And also because the University of Wyoming in 1998 was one of the few colleges that they saw that had an LGBT club.
Mm-hmm.
I think at the time that was all of the letters that they had.
Yeah.
So they were really excited about that, where he would get a community both for what he was interested in and who he was. Matt ended up going to the University of Wyoming, which is in Laramie, Wyoming. And while he was not 18 and it was not his first time going to college, I do believe he entered as a first year, like a freshman, basically, at the age of 21. Now, this is in 1998. And when he went, it was so cool. Like, I think about this for him in the way that I think of a kid sitting at home dreaming of a world that accepts him and going to a place where for the first time he sees someone light up to see someone like him.
Aww.
He went, and this queer club was run by an openly lesbian professor, which was pretty rare. I mean, this is 1998. Ellen just came out in 1997.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, she had that little magazine cover that said, "Yep, I'm gay." And then he went here and it was like, oh my God, people like me.
Mm-hmm.
People are here and I'm safe and I can be like this. So he joins this club. And of course, because it's Matt and he is literally just this guy, he also immediately starts an LGBT mentoring club. He sets it up so that new students can have somebody like them to help get them settled in and show them the ropes. And I'm like, what a guy. Like, that is exactly who he wants to be. He's always out to help people. He loves taking action on things like this. Like, it was just the perfect welcoming. At a summer picnic, Matt met a woman named Tina Labrie. She was a married anthropology major, and they went on to become fast friends. Tina was married with a family, and Tina's husband, Phil, got along well with Matt, but their kids also idolized Matt. Tina recalled one time that Matt said he thought Phil was the first straight man he'd ever met that wasn't afraid of him.
Aww.
And Matt even told Tina some of his suicidal ideations, including ways that he thought he might do it. And like, the two became fast friends. They became close so quickly that Matt even asked Tina if, when he passed, she would take care of his cat. And Tina, of course, agreed, thinking it would be long in the future, and talked at the same time about making Matt her children's godfather. Tina wasn't the only friend Matt was close to, though. Matt joined that queer club run by Romaine Patterson. And Romaine and Matt became friends, too. She would work at like a coffee shop or something that he'd go to frequently.
Is this the professor?
This is the professor.
Okay, yeah.
And Romaine says Matt was hesitant in dating. again, like I'd imagine at this time and place, like in the 90s in Wyoming, I don't know how open I'd be about it either.
Well, yeah. And also you're not just going to just jump into a relationship with the first, like he's tried how many different schools and it hasn't worked out. He's easing into it. He's making friends.
Right.
He's probably focusing on a school. Like, is the first goal to just start a relationship? Maybe, maybe not.
Right. And the other thing that's worth mentioning here that I heard that I just think is so funny, at least to me, after you like come out to someone and they're like, are you into me? And it's like, just because you're the gender someone's attracted to, or you present as the gender that someone is attracted to, doesn't mean you're their type. He might not have found anyone he liked. He might have been like, ugh, too stuck up. Ugh, I don't know. Ugh. Like,
yeah, your personality sucks.
Yeah. Who knows? And Matt deserves someone with a good fucking personality, damn it.
Hell yeah.
So Romaine and him were close. And again, he was hesitant. He did not ever want to hit on a straight man, even if he thought they were attractive, because he was afraid of what might happen. I didn't mention this, but in one of the schools that he went to previously in Colorado, there was an issue with a bartender. Matt, I guess, had been drinking and got a little reckless. He woke up and didn't remember what had happened, but had a split lip and like a bruise or something. And he found out through some order of events, which I don't know all of, which is why I didn't put it all in here, but he had actually gotten beaten up a little bit, at least, by a bartender that he hit on while he was in Colorado.
Oh.
And the bartender basically just said, yeah, he came on to me and I didn't like it, so I beat him up.
That's awful.
And I don't really know what else came of it, but this is now the second time that Matt's been at least physically assaulted in some way. And he was super hesitant to get into any other situation like this. So Matt ended up meeting a 36-year-old man online. There was obviously an age gap, but they were both clearly interested in each other. And they talked online like regularly for months. And Matt still wouldn't meet him. He was terrified to meet this guy, who I'll leave pretty much out of it because he doesn't really have any other role in this, said that Matt told him he was afraid that something more serious would happen, that he was afraid. So Matt may have been outgoing and not shy, but he certainly wasn't brazen or reckless when it came to love.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, Matt got comfortable enough to set up a meeting with his internet love interest, but it was a few weeks out. And by the time that date came, Matt wouldn't be around to see him.
Mm-hmm.
Along with all of this, though, Matt was depressed and sad and in a bad way. His agreement with his parents was that he would try his absolute best this semester, but if that didn't work out, he would try something else. Maybe more intensive therapy, maybe something else entirely. So when midterm started coming up, Matt felt a lot of pressure to perform in order to keep his college life going. And I think this is a good thing. Like, you set a limit and you push yourself to meet that goal, and if you don't, you regroup and figure out a new way or a new goal. But Matt was equally excited to be at college as he was afraid of failing, I think. And this extra pressure that he put on himself didn't really help. His parents were all for him being healthy in whatever that looked like. They didn't really care, to my knowledge, if he graduated from the University of Wyoming in 2001 or 2003.
Mm-hmm.
They were first and foremost interested in keeping him healthy and safe.
Yeah, as a parent should be.
As the weeks went by in the semester, and we got to October, Matt and Tina had a fun night out on the second. They rented a limousine from a man that Matt made an interesting connection with. He hated driving his truck, and Tina noted that he felt lost being in it because he was so small and such a big vehicle. They went out, they drank, they talked about life, they sat outside and discussed their hopes and fears. This night is actually when Matt disclosed to her how often he thought of suicide and how low he felt. But he also shared that he didn't feel like he was at a place where he was going to do anything. Tina, that night, went home with him and stayed over. She didn't want to leave him alone. But the next morning when she woke up, Matt was on the phone fighting with his mom over money. he had overdrawn his bank account, and I guess that wasn't an unusual thing for him.
Oh, Matt.
But Matt was also like a kid and in college, and not that he should be taking advantage of it, but his parents did have money. His dad was in the oil industry, so he wasn't necessarily wanting outside of a phone call to mom. So it wasn't a huge deal, but they did fight about it.
He had a cushion if he needed it.
A safety net. Tina really wanted to stay and make sure he was okay, but she had to get home and take care of her girls and her currently sick husband, Phil. Matt assured her he'd be okay, and later that weekend, he made up with his mom, telling her that he loved her and he was really sorry that he was going to try to do better about it, but, you know, that he didn't mean anything that he said if it was mean, and all was well.
Mm.
But it wasn't until days later that something was notably wrong. See, Tina had gone home that day and didn't hear from him for a little bit. And she was stressed at first, but they weren't like abnormally connected at the hip. You know, they were both college kids. She was married. She had kids. Like, she had things to do. He had stuff to do. But they did stay in contact. And so for the first few days after this, Tina didn't hear from him. But she saw him at a restaurant, so she felt a little better. But the week went on, and come Tuesday or Wednesday, she had called and still hadn't really heard back from him and started getting worried after their conversation. She wanted to make sure her friend was okay.
Mm-hmm.
So she went to go and look for him. But on Wednesday, when she couldn't find him, she got really worried and called the police.
That's a good friend, though.
She's a really good friend. I mean, not only did she go out with him and she sat there and connected with him, but she also sat in the shit with him. And that's really all you can do as a friend, right? Is sit through the suffering with the people that you love.
Yeah, and she's keeping an eye on him. And when she's not hearing from him, I mean, I think a lot of times in school, too, you might just write it off as, oh, well, maybe they're with somebody else, or maybe they went home, or maybe family. I mean, I don't know.
It's, right.
You could spend 25-8 with somebody, and then you could go 3 weeks and maybe run into them in the dining hall. And then, you know, because life can get crazy, you're kind of campus living, and that's a different kind of life. And
oh, it is.
She let like a couple of days go by.
Yeah. And it was great. So she called the police. And when she called, she asked the police to complete a welfare check on Matt, which was met by a really long silence and then questions. Weird questions, actually. Like, if Matt had any enemies or if anybody would want to hurt him.
Hmm.
And Tina was like, okay, that's weird, but I tried to help. She told them everything she could. And before she got much further, the police said they were going to send an officer over. Tina was anxious and upset because she wanted a welfare check on him. She didn't want a police officer to come to her.
Right.
So a police officer showed up and started asking questions. They didn't really explain anything. They just kept asking more questions.
Uh-oh.
In fact, it was that morning, October 7th, that Matt had been found by a freshman at the University of Wyoming. He was a cyclist riding his little bike around, and his name was Aaron Kreifels, I think is how you pronounce it. He had mistaken him for a scarecrow. It was just a few weeks before Halloween, so everybody was, you know, decorating, and he came across this fence with what looked like a scarecrow on it, and he actually had fallen off of his bike. He like hit something and took a stumble, and that's how he saw Matt. And then he kind of went up and was like, oh shit, that's a person. And then he saw the labored breathing and was like, oh my god, this guy is still alive.
Oh.
Matt had been brutally beaten, tied with his hands behind his back and up onto a fence for hours in October in Wyoming. Aaron didn't know this at the time, so he, of course, called 911, as you should. And Matt ends up getting taken to the hospital. I'll talk about the first responders, but around this time also, somebody calls his parents in Saudi Arabia. They had to fly home to identify him, and it took them over 50 hours to fly back.
Could you imagine what those 50 hours were like? That's more than 2 days.
Yep. And they didn't even know what was going on. They were just told that he was found badly beat, like in a bad way, basically. They didn't know if he was beaten. They assumed it was like a car crash at first, because if you hear something like that out of the blue, who's going to assume?
Yep.
That it's an attack like this.
And if you need someone to identify, I mean, then you're thinking he's not well enough to answer questions. I mean, he can't tell them who he is.
Right. And so they didn't even know what had happened to him. And when they landed, they learned that it was potentially a hate crime and that he had been beaten, but that it was national fucking news.
What?
Before the time they landed in this country, the entire country knew.
So they get off the plane and there's probably cameras in their face.
Yep. The hospital described the media like locusts.
Ugh. Vultures.
What marked their identification of Matt was his braces. His face was so beaten and puffy, it was hard to tell that it was him, other than some scars he'd had on his arms from his life and his braces.
Mm.
When first responders came to the scene, though, that morning on October 7th, they noted that Matt's face had blood all over it, except in two or three areas where his tears had washed away the blood stains. Matt's body, with his hands tied behind his back and then again to a fence, had been so close to lifeless that that cyclist thought that he was an actual scarecrow and didn't see him breathing at first.
Ugh.
Matt, being short and small, was at first mistaken for a child. The first responder who got to him first recounts thinking that he was 12 and going into life-saving mode. Mm. She cleared his airways and did CPR. Actually, interesting, I heard on Morbid, I didn't know which source they got this from, but allegedly she had had one pair of gloves last and they broke, and she was just so desperate to save his life that she didn't care. She just kept going.
Wow.
Which, you know, I'm not going to say be reckless or flippant, but that's heroic to say, I don't know what I'm in for, but I'm in it to see you live another day. Something else that she noted, however, was that a doe was nearby waiting. He was out tied to this fence in like this vast field, prairie type of location. And this beautiful deer was just sitting there watching over him. And when the first responder came and she started all of her life-preserving techniques, so she noted that this deer was not afraid when she came up. It didn't skitter off or look at her like it was about to die. Instead, it was peaceful and it was calm. And when it saw that she had things covered, it sort of stood up and looked at her and walked away.
She was watching over him and making sure he was okay.
Said that boy needs someone here. And that deer was that someone. And I would like to once again say that animals are way too good for people.
And they are.
When the police showed up after, they noted that there was blood spatter in a 50-foot radius.
50 feet?
Feet. The evidence from the blood spatter also showed that Matt fought back, and he fought back hard, at times even running away and being dragged back. By the time Matt's parents had shown up, so had everyone else in the world. The hospital again described them as locusts. I guess the clusters and swarms they appeared in was a little too Old Testament for them to overlook. It turned out that Tuesday, October 6th, 1998, Matt was supposed to go out with his friends for a birthday, but Matt canceled, needing to study and go to his club meeting. Matt went to his LGBT meeting at the University of Wyoming and must have decided there that he wanted to go out to a club called Fireside. I think it was just like a regular sports bar, not really like a full club, but Fireside. He tried to convince some friends from the group to go, but nobody did. They all had to sleep or study or, you know, do some other college kid thing.
Yep.
He had a friend drive him home who saw him go inside, but he must have left after that because that night he did go to that Fireside bar. According to a variety of reports, Matt had gone into the bar and had a few Heinekens talking with the bartender. It is in my head, like I can just so clearly picture this. Like Matt is this small statured guy who is so friendly and has like the biggest smile on his face. I picture him in like a little pair of jeans and a sports coat and like drinking his Heineken, like chatting it up with the bartender, like, hey, how's life? How you doing? What's going on? And if he went there frequently, which he might have, how are the kids? How's the wife? You know, how's the business? Like, that's just the kind of guy that he was. And so he's hanging out there and he's talking to the bartender. He ends up talking to the bartender when two men, Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson, came inside. They wanted to get a pitcher of beer. Didn't say hi to Matt. No indication that they might have known each other. Got their pitcher of beer. And I shit you not, according to the bartender, paid in nickels and dimes entirely.
That is a college kid.
Right? So the two men came in. They played pool for a while. And around the same time, all three of them left. The bartender thought it was a little weird because, like, they obviously weren't friends. They weren't chatting. But what can you do? That's life. And it's Wyoming and small town. So if you're going to get a ride, like, you're probably going to get a ride from a guy at the bar.
Yeah.
And that's just kind of how it went. So according to Aaron McKinney, one of the men, Matt came up and said he was interested, which led Aaron and Russell to agree to pretend to be gay so that they could lead him on, get him in their truck, and rob him. They thought, that kid looks a little too nicely dressed for this college town. He has money, I bet.
And he's short and easy to overpower, so great. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And now he's gay, so that's an in. There we go. So the three left in the truck. And by the way, they did this. They got into the truck, and at some point, he was told that, listen, dude, we are not gay, and we are robbing you. So
that's terrifying.
Of taking him home, Aaron McKinney, who was not driving, started beating Matt and told him that they wanted their wallet. And Matt very willingly gave him his wallet. Like, very willingly gave him his wallet.
They could have just grabbed his wallet. I mean, you could have just not done anything to him at all, never spoken to him at all. But
the 100% less effort.
The next best thing you could have done here was let him go after that. Like, if we're this far.
But that's not what happened. Instead, Russell drove the truck while Aaron started beating Matt up. And instead of going home, they drove him out to this big field at the end of a dead-end road. That's where the fence was that Matt was later found tied to. Russell tied up Matt's hands and Aaron continued to beat him. He pistol whipped him and punched his head essentially somewhere between 18 and 20 times. The blow that did it, though, was a pistol whip behind his right ear. Could have been his left, but it caved his skull in and crushed his brainstem, which is like where all of your basic functioning is. So like you're breathing and you're eating and drinking and blinking. And then they essentially left him for dead. They thought he was dead. They kept him tied. I should say at some point they did get stressed out because they thought that he could identify their car. So they hit him in the head again. And then they took his shoes so that he wouldn't run away.
What?
Yeah.
You didn't have to do any of that.
Nope.
I'm just thinking 18 to 20 times just in the head. Yeah. I mean, I don't. Just think of the focus and effort it takes to punch something. 18 to 20 times like that, not even another human being, but I mean just like that rage or whatever that is, but like the strength, like you get tired, you will break a sweat with that. That isn't something as simple as like flooring it in the car or a stab wound or something like that,
or even a gunshot.
Like none of that is as impulsive.
Yep. No, it's personal and it is up close and it is brutal. The two also made Matt tell them his address so that they could go rob his place when they were done.
Come on.
When they left, Matt's injuries were so bad that they assumed he was dead later on. And I don't remember if it was the coroner or if it was one of the detectives on the scene, but they noted that it was such bad injuries that they had only ever seen anything like it in brutal car accidents.
Oh, and he just lived through that for hours.
Yeah, he was left outside tied to that post for 18 hours before the cyclist found him.
18 hours.
It was only October, but it did dip below freezing that night. So he was out there without shoes, without a coat, without anything, tied up to this fence, unable to speak or scream, just writhing in pain, clinging to life.
I just want to hold him.
When the two left, they did plan to rob Matt, but they got distracted by a fight with two Hispanic men. Funny enough.
So they didn't go to his, where he was living, to go rob the place?
No, because they wanted to fight these two guys, you know? And so they did, because I guess their night of terror wasn't done. They weren't, like, done having fun yet.
Okay.
So they beat up these two 18-year-olds. Mm-hmm. And eventually the cops were called, which meant Aaron and Russell ran away. But they did leave Matt's shoes and wallet inside of the truck. What else happened, though, that is kind of insane to think about, was during this fight, Aaron is, like, kind of the leader. He's more violent of the two of them. He got into an altercation with one of these men who ended up giving him a hairline fracture in the skull.
Good.
So he ends up going to the hospital.
No.
He does. And he's roomed four rooms down from where Matt is.
Are you serious?
For a period of time, they were four rooms away from each other. Did they connect
the dots that, oh my God, we have a assailant and victim? Because what if he got up and just went and, like, finished Matt off?
He could have.
Oh.
So just terrifying. But that night, they did leave Matt tied in the dirt. He ended up going into a coma, and once he was at the hospital, he was on life support. His friends, Tina, Romaine, and others, and his family came out to see him. Ultimately, his injuries were deemed too fragile to operate on, and he was transferred to the, I think it's called Pud Valley Hospital in Fort Collins. It's Poudre. This did fully make me sob. Actually, when I was researching it, I had to take, like, a lot of breaks researching this one. Matt's dad, Dennis, had obviously flown home from Saudi Arabia the 50 hours with Matt's mom.
Mm-hmm.
He was found on October 7th, and somewhere in there, Dennis made the four-hour drive back to Laramie, Wyoming, or I think maybe even still in Casper, Wyoming, where they grew up,
mm-hmm,
to go to a storage unit because he wanted to get Matt's stuffed bunny Oscar that he loved as a kid to bring it to him in the hospital, because he just wanted to bring something of Matt's that made Matt feel like himself. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't find it at the time, but he did later find it, and he still has it now, and he'll, like, hug it when he wants to remember Matt. But Matt's mom, dad, and brother had been at the hospital and by his side for days, devastated to see their son and brother on life support. They noted that the only way they could tell it was Matt was, again, his braces and a few of those scars. Devastated, as Matt didn't get better as the days went on, his parents refused to take him off life support. They weren't sure if that was going to result in some sort of criminal charge. I doubt that it would, but I also don't know what the offense leading up to it.
Right.
How that goes. So they refused to do it. But also, it's your son.
I'm sure there were many reasons why they
couldn't
decide. I mean, what do you do?
I can imagine. I'm not a parent, but I can imagine as a parent, you give everything you have, including life, to this sweet baby, and you raise it to be exactly the kind of person that Matt was. He was open. He was kind. He was smart. He was funny. He was welcoming. To be put in a situation where he lives and suffers constantly, or you end it for him, I think that would wreck me. I think I would literally implode before I could make that choice. I wouldn't know what to do. And they knew at this point that if Matt did live, it was a very limited capacity of a life that he'd be having. The quality would not be the same. He likely would need someone with him constantly if he made it through the hospital at all.
Yeah, I mean, damage to your brainstem. Not good.
Not good. So devastated, Judy, Matt's mom, called his high school guidance counselor, Walt. If you remember me saying, Walt was the first person that Matt ever came out to. And he was terrified. And Walt went in and he was, I think, equally honored and afraid to get this phone call. And I think I'd feel the same way. But Judy just said, we can't take him off. Can you please go in and tell him it's okay to let go? Like, I also can't tell him to let go, but like, tell him it's okay to let go. And Walt did.
Wow.
He went out there. He went into the room. At some point, I think he even told Matt that it wasn't fair to make his parents take him off, that he had to let go on his own.
Oh.
And Matt did that night, actually.
Oh.
He died holding hands with his mom and his brother and his dad around him in the hospital. So ultimately, somewhere in the hour of midnight on October 12th, 1998, after 5 days in a coma, being left for dead for 18 hours in the freezing Wyoming fall, after having some drinks and catching a ride home and maybe hitting on a man. He was beaten, humiliated, comatose, depressed, anxious, and ultimately assaulted in so many ways in just a short fucking 21 years. Matt's funeral wasn't long after, though, on October 18th. Despite it being in October, there was a giant snowstorm that came in. Like, huge, you know? And even more miraculously was after the snowstorm, so many people came to the service that they had to open a second church.
Wow.
That's the love and the support that people outcried for this family. But also during this fucking time, the Westboro Baptist Church was out and about. I don't know if you know much about them. But they are they call themselves a church. It's very extreme beliefs in Christianity, and they will go and protest many queer, other sin type things. And so at the funeral of a murdered 21-year-old, where his family is grieving and he happened to be gay, this church showed up with a small group, but a large enough group that it was notable to protest.
What exactly are they protesting? His death? Yeah, gay. Us too. We're all upset about that. We can all agree.
No, they came in and they protested against the street with heinous signs. I'm going to give a trigger warning here for gay slurs, but some of them said Matt in hell with a picture of his face on it. Some of them said God hates fags. There's a picture of a child, like a fucking child, holding a sign of two stick figures doing anal.
Okay.
That says something about like fag equals anal sex equals burn in hell. At his funeral.
Even out of context, funeral and no funeral, I don't have words for that. But then you bring that to...
And it's not... And I, again, no death is an easy death. It's not. But this was a young man. Borderline child. He was definitely an adult, but he was just over that line. Who was brutally murdered. And you're going to come here with your fucking 5-year-old to tell his grieving family that he's burning in hell?
He was 21 years old, but probably mentally younger. I mean, not like cognitively, but I mean like relied on mom and dad for a lot.
Mm-hmm.
still had a lot of growing and maturing to do, and that's not uncommon.
No, his brain wouldn't be fully developed for another 4 years.
And
at least
certainly already been through a lot in his 21 years, trauma that you and I can't imagine.
No.
And he gets essentially kidnapped and robbed and beaten to death.
Yeah.
And he happened to be gay.
Yep.
So that's what we're gonna, but we're gonna protest that. That's
the hill we're dying on.
So we're not gonna protest the animals that attacked him.
No. No, okay. The Westboro Baptist Church is infamous for many reasons, including many protests with just culturally, morally deaf signage. There's one picture that always, like, it literally haunts my head. It says AIDS cured fags.
Ugh.
Yeah. Disgusting things. I don't even like saying it as much as I have in this episode, but I mean, I don't want you to think anything better of these people. Like, I don't want to censor it and make them sound
not as
more approachable.
No. I know what you mean.
Even more surreal than this protest somehow. And this is like the fucking, I swear this is the power of Matt Shepard, more than the protesters. More surreal than that was both of the churches, with the large masses of people there to celebrate, honor, and respect Matt's life, hearing the heinous things they were shouting, because they were shouting too, because why not, right? Held hands and sang Amazing Grace just to try to fucking tune it out.
Oh, I'm gonna cry. That is beautiful.
Something that I really love that happened later on was that Romaine, that I believe the professor that led that club and one of Matt's friends, later started a group called Angel Action, which to my knowledge is still active today. And they go out with a bunch of people anytime they hear that the Westboro Baptist Church is out in angel costumes with wings that are like 10 feet wide and 7 feet tall. And they will just stand and hold hands and sing in front of them to block out whatever they're doing. It took almost no time for the police to find Aaron and Russell. Both were young contractors or roofers, depending on the source, who sporadically worked. They liked alcohol and got into trouble. And while Aaron McKinney was known to be a bit of a hothead who was violent, in and out of trouble with police, outwardly homophobic and racist, and had prior robbery charges, Russell was more of a follower than anything else. He also had run-ins with the law, but it was primarily around drinking and driving, DUIs, losing his license, and minor related charges. Both were broke. Both liked meth.
Gotcha.
That'll come up later. Initially, Aaron and Russell said that they went to the bar and got a pitcher. Again, they paid in their literal fucking nickels and dimes, and they saw Matt. Matt, whether seemingly flamboyant or just dressed nicely, they had clocked as gay and affluent. Maybe it was his worldliness, or maybe it was the hot sports coat he had on. But they claimed to trick him in order to get him in their truck for money.
Now, how old are they?
They're around the same age.
But they're not students.
They're just locals.
So they're townies hanging out at the townie bar. They're sniffing out the college kids. They think that he's got mom and dad's money, and they're not wrong.
Right.
But I mean, probably not in his pocket.
They don't know that he just overdrafted his bank account, right? That he just had a fight about. So it was kind of fruitless in that sense. But
if he were 6'5" and built like a linebacker, they'd probably be like, okay, not him.
Or like a mustard stained Packers shirt. I'm sorry, Wyoming. I don't know who you fucking root for. But you know what I mean? Like,
well, yeah, but like he was an easy target because he was small.
Yeah. Yeah. And in all of the sources I've read, they say that the money was for drugs, specifically meth. In quite a few sources, they point to this as a reason the two wanted money, as well as an alternate motive for Matt's murder, being either that he owed them money for meth to Aaron McKinney, the other one being that they wanted money to get drugs themselves. But we'll get there, I promise, just not quite yet. Regardless of the motive, the two took him into their truck and reported that Matt had either put his hand on their thigh or balls, depending on what source you read. And that sent them into a rage. They told him, look, we're not gay and this is a robbery. And despite immediately starting to pistol whip Matt in the face with his gun, Aaron had no problems getting the wallet as Matt handed it right over. Keep in mind, all he had was $20 in his wallet and the debit card linked to that overdrafted account. But Aaron continually hit Matt while Russell drove them to a secluded place where they beat him mercilessly. And I would just like to point out that, yes, they did have the guy with no license and a bunch of DUIs driving.
Great.
Which was his previous crime of choice. And Aaron was the one doing all of the violence, which is his previous crime of choice. And it's just like a real yin yang, you know?
It's just really great when we just catch and release, catch and release, catch and release. Right, guys?
Know your strengths.
It's really working out.
The two...
We said dress for the job you want, not the job you have.
Clearly. So the two took his shoes to not let him run away and continued to beat him for fear that they could...
Who can't run with shoes on?
Right.
Oh no, you took my shoes. Now I'm stuck. The floor's lava. Come on. Fuck out of here. I think it was the brain damage, though.
Yeah.
That was going to keep him in place probably more than the shoes.
Yeah, that would do it.
But that's just my opinion.
And again, they tried to get his address so they could rob himself after, but then got distracted with their other dumb fuckery. So,
unreal.
In the questioning, Aaron McKinney said that he went into a blind panic because of Matt's advances and that he wasn't gay and wanted to teach him a lesson for being too aggressive and coming on to straight men.
Nope.
Later, this was recanted, as well as whatever was stated initially that Matt did to come on to them. So whether it was grabbing their thigh or their balls, they later recanted that as well.
Are they also saying that Matt went for both their balls at the same time?
I guess.
That's, I mean...
Ballsy?
I mean, also pretty... And they're saying he's not athletic?
You said gotta get him low and fast.
I'm just saying, all that would be tricky.
Yep.
To say the least. And
tricky even when you're not being pistol whipped.
Quick like a tomcat is all I'm going to say.
Yeah.
Just almost seems like you couldn't do that in a moving vehicle amidst being robbed. But anyway.
And yeah.
Who
know. Among us? I don't know. I've never had to be scrappy like that, thankfully.
I just hate
them. But I don't think that he should have had to either.
I just hate them.
Nor do I think out of any of the people that know him and love him and have interacted with him who have said that he was not brazen or reckless with his sexual advances for fear of his fucking life after being beaten and gang raped in Morocco would lead him to hit on two men from Wyoming and rural Wyoming while he was talking to someone else online and also had no indicator that they were gay or interested.
I also don't, even if he did hit on them, okay.
Exactly.
If they're saying that they pretended to be gay to get him to leave with them, then okay. So and whether just, you're gay or straight, like you're interested or you're not. If you're not, that's it. That ends. I don't care.
Oh, wait.
If we were into each other or we could be, or you check my boxes or not, if that's not, if I'm not in the mood for that right now, then that is where that ends.
Bye-bye.
And cool that goes for both of us on both sides. You leave me alone, I leave you alone.
Fab. Easy.
Incredible.
But that's not all. Yes, it was later recanted, but it wasn't recanted for some time. Because in the actual court hearing, do you want to know what the defense was that they used?
I would love to.
They used a defense that is still fucking on the books, by the way, called the gay panic defense.
I'm sorry, I'm going to need you to say more on that.
The gay panic defense is a defense that alleges that very rationally, because all straight people are right and reasonable to be afraid of gay people, that in the event that a gay person comes on to you or approaches you and you're uncomfortable, that it's rational to go into a blind rage and beat them, if not murder them. Well, because you're not like that.
What?
Yeah. It is not used as a full defense. And lately, I believe there has been some legislation limiting what you can use it on. But yeah, as far as I know, it was used even in 2018.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to need to process that for a little bit. I'm going to need you to keep going.
So I'm not going to spend too long on the court case because it's exhausting. And frankly, if I went into it, this would be a 9-parter.
Mm.
But the long of it short is that Aaron McKinney and Russell Henderson were both found guilty and sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms without the possibility of parole.
They each got 2 life terms, or
yes,
they got 1 each?
They each got 2 consecutive.
Okay.
Which is fabulous. So if they die and they come back to life miraculously, they still got another one to go, baby.
Ayy.
Which we love. And we live in LWAP.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I was kidding about the gay panic defense, but that is absolutely what was used. I believe in Aaron's case, I think Russell actually pled out to escape the death penalty and in exchange testified against Aaron.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Aaron's, it was beautiful. I cannot repeat it for fear of actually bursting into tears. But if you ever get a chance to look up the victim impact statement from Dennis, Matt's dad, you should. The long of it short, again, is just that he tells Aaron that he is not giving him death because that would be too good for him. And he hopes he lives a long life. And every birthday and 4th of July and Christmas that he celebrates, he thanks Matt. Because he's doing what Matt wanted, not what he wanted.
Wow.
I want to talk about the gay panic defense for a moment, though, because I think it's actually fucking heinous. As a woman, I was raised in public school. I was told to cover my shoulders, that my bra straps couldn't show, that my shorts had to be lower than my fingertips to make sure that I was comfortable being in a room, regardless of what old pedophiles might ogle me if something was too revealing. Because, hey, the cute boys are looking, but the old fucks are too. I was taught to be smart and compassionate and empathetic and kind and healthy and funny and to hold my tongue and to be quiet when I was supposed to dress the way I was supposed to look, to talk the way I was supposed to speak. But none of that mattered if my tan bra strap became visible and distracted a male classmate into staring at me or getting off topic in class, because apparently they can't control themselves, I can control them. The gay panic defense is the equivalent to a woman being able to say she murdered a man because he hit on her and she wasn't expecting it. Why do we as a society never fucking take accountability? Can we just hold individuals responsible for their own actions in things? Why are women responsible for men's actions and gay people responsible for straight people's actions? Can you just fucking do it yourself?
Mm-hmm.
There is a lot of aftermath to this, so stay with me. Because while both Aaron and Russell are spending 2 consecutive life sentences without parole in prison, much has continued on with this case and the intertwined culture, media, and the facts of the case, which has led to a much murkier, fucked up view of the crime in current day than initially was thought. What I presented to you were the facts of the case as I heard them as they came out. Stated in court and in all the local sources I had heard, including the investigation and the trial. But what I haven't given you yet is the alternate story, which is a bit more controversial. In 2004, a few years after this, 2020 put out an expose that suggested there was more behind the tale and that there were different motives than everyone thought. The alternate story states that Matt was actually deep into the meth scene and that he tried to get away from the drug scene, but felt as though it constantly pulled him back in, no matter what city he went to. Due to this, the connection was that he knew Aaron from the dealing, and that they knew each other prior, which the bartender and Matt's friends denied. But the bartender said they didn't even interact or say hello, which would have been weird if they knew each other. Further, evidence came out to suggest that Aaron himself was bisexual, which led a lot of people to say, well then, hey, this can't be a hate crime. He's bi. Which they're clearly nobody who was raised with internalized homophobia then. Good for them. But let's unpack this, because if you're curious about more information on this take, I am begging you to listen to the podcast You're Wrong About. They did an episode on this that was delightful with a fellow Wyomingite who is now a lawyer, studied journalism, and went to the University of Wyoming in 1999, the year after all of this happened. So he has like very close connections with this case, which made it very interesting to hear his take on everything. I think it provides valuable insight on Wyoming culture, their very positive response to this, and the area as a whole. I don't in any way want to paint Wyoming as a bigoted, gay-hating, meth-using state. In fact, I believe that every single state probably has bigoted, gay-hating Matthews. Every state also has really delightful, kind, informed, loving people. And it's no different in a city. You'll get both everywhere.
Mm.
In this episode of You're Wrong About, they review the case facts of the Matthew Shepard case and discuss it in length, not just the impact and why the methamphetamine motive doesn't really work out as a sole motive in this context. I'm not denying, nor were they or anyone else who paid attention to the initial facts, that this story included robbery and drugs one way or another. Whether they were looking for money from Matt to get drugs, whether Matt owed money for drugs, or perhaps they just wanted extra because they were on their stash. Maybe both, who knows? But it's a bit incredulous to suggest that the existence of meth use or the potential knowledge of each other means that this crime had nothing to do with Matt's sexuality. In the 2020 expose, they also suggest that Aaron McKinney was bisexual, using that as a mitigating fact for any potential consideration of the hate crime motivation. I will, as I often do when I have an appropriate platform, talk about this from my perspective as a straight passing queer person in the United States, but let's talk about why this came out. Because despite his court case being, "I'm a homophobe, not a murderer," he then later changes his tune and he's like, "I'm a murderer, not a homophobe."
Oh no.
"I'm bi. How could it be related?" And despite these contradictions never being pointed out, the other piece of evidence to suggest Aaron was bi was faulty at best as well. The 2020 expose interviewed a guy named Doc Brown, who you may remember me mentioning as a limo driver the night that Tina and Matt went out. Doc knew that Matt was gay, alleging at some point that he asked for a ride to a gay bar in Fort Collins, and they had a good laugh and a great ride. Doc also reported that he had been interviewed and relayed meeting Matt a few nights before the attack, consistent with Tina's version of the limo story. But Doc also later stated that he knew Matt a long time and even had gone to Subway and dinner with him and talked about life for a few hours.
Mm.
Doc also happened to know that Aaron McKinney was bi, well, quote unquote, at least bi, because he himself, Doc McKinney, had a three-way with him in his limo.
Ugh.
So that's not what I would call a consistent story.
No.
On either of their parts, really. And we love to point out that Aaron says, "Hey, I'm bi, it can't be a hate crime, so why would we further any gay legislation or gay protecting legislation?" But we seem to overlook the fact that when he was asked if he knew Doc, he says no. He has no idea who that is.
Hmm.
So apparently he can tell the truth whenever it's convenient for us and the narrative we're trying to spin.
Correct.
But he's lying about everything else, I guess. And Doc, despite giving very contradictory information, was still put on TV. Like, he was a credible source.
He wanted his 15 minutes so bad.
He did. And the thing about being around somebody who you've had even an acquaintance interaction with who dies in such a public way is you get everybody telling you that they are their best friend.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to have a lot of journalistic integrity to really sort that out.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that this specific case did.
Yep.
But let's talk about homophobia and hate crime definitions. The federal government calls a hate crime, at the federal level, a crime committed by bias against race, color, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, gender, gender identity, or disability. This does not state that this has to be entirely motivated or the exclusive motivation of an attack. Further, in court, Aaron's girlfriend, who is also a piece of poop, and another trigger warning here for that F word, the night he came home, he said, "I might have killed the fag."
And she said, "I'm calling 911.
No, right? She actually said, "How can we help you? What alibi can we give you?"
Are you serious?
I'm very serious. She's also a piece of poop. Of course, both of their girlfriends, Russell had one too, surprisingly, they're both kind of punchable looking, but both of their girlfriends did this. And they were like, "But they were just trying to teach the gay boy a lesson." I'm sure they called him a worse word.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So they weren't really worried. And I'm going to go ahead and say, if you are comfortable calling people a fag or a faggot, that is rooted in some hate. Personally, it doesn't really impact me. But nobody's ever tried to use it to discriminate against me or make me feel less than. And it's never been used by someone who would be an oppressor in that sense to me either. But if it was related to the meth or to the drugs or just a robbery, quote unquote, gone wrong, which I don't believe in a million years, that doesn't mean that it's not a hate crime. Again, nowhere in that definition does it say it has to be exclusively or solely motivated by this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this happens for a lot of hate crimes. I don't think people get together and like scheme like, "Oh, we're going to go kill a gay person tonight." I think you're out living your life and something that might aggravate you or make you afraid is escalated by some sort of bias or hatred that you have for what that person represents to you. And that's not making an excuse for it. But the reason that I bring this up was that there was a lot of progress in the wake of Matt's murder. Like I said, this was national news before his parents were back to see him in the hospital. So laws were passed to help add legislation protecting people from hate crimes. Wyoming, according to that You're Wrong About podcast, went through a period of trying to show how tolerant they were, which is kind of funny, but like actually good. Like, hey, these two people aren't all of Wyoming. We aren't all this. Right. You're okay. You're safe. And it might not be like a rainbow flag waving state with them in every single window. But they were trying to say, like, you are welcome here.
Mm-hmm.
And we will do something if people treat you like this. Also, President of the fucking United States, Bill Clinton, made statements about it, giving his condolences to the Shepherd family. Obama later passed legislation in part related to Matt and in part related to an African-American man who was killed by white supremacists, adding classes to protected information in the hate crime definition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hell, when it first happened, Ellen DeGeneres was out and Will and Grace was on. Like, progress was happening. We had gone from this place where AIDS was rampant and giant and terrifying and taking out people left and right who were afraid and alone, by the way, who were afraid and alone before they became sick and then became sick with a fatal disease and everybody turned their back on them, which is great and comforting in and of itself. But you come from this to a place where Ellen can say, "I'm gay," and now we have a sitcom with a gay person. And there was an SNL skit that was like, NBC saw Will and Grace is doing so well, they added a lesbian to every single sitcom, which is funny and honestly probably would work. But like, it felt okay. And then this happens and it's like a culture shock of, nope, we are not there yet. And the reason that I bring up the hate crimes and all of this cultural movement is that people, when they try to use this methamphetamine alternate motive as a way to debunk a gay hate crime, as a way to take away from Matt, as a way to make him less of a victim, it takes away from the movement. And part of the reason I was hoping that you would all listen to that You're Wrong About podcast is because they do a really great deep dive on what it's like to have to tie trends to crimes. We as people have to do that, right? Like, for example, if I told you that people with brown eyes were being mass murdered, you'd probably look at me and go, okay, weirdo. Why? I have brown eyes. I'm alive. Where's your evidence? Mm-hmm. Give me an example. And so you have to give an example. In this case, the trend is not people with brown eyes. It's gay hate crimes. And the evidence is Matt, right? He was the first really nationally, I want to say, like, advertised gay hate crime where people were like, this is really not right. Like, something here does not add up. And there is this interesting thing with trends like this. And I love how they say it in this podcast episode, which is why I'm going to defer you there. But they talk about when you debunk a piece of evidence like this for a greater trend, people think it debunks the trend. That, oh, well, Matt must have been into meth, so he wasn't really a gay hate crime victim. He was a meth user who, I guess the logic there is, maybe somehow deserved it more. Or that it was not solely related to this, so that the gay hate crime part of this isn't really an issue. But you take those two things separate, and they're both isolated truths, right? Whether or not Matt was just a gay man in a bar, or if he was a gay man in a bar who liked to experiment with drugs because he was 21 and fucking traumatized in a time where mental health services weren't as widely available. And not for nothing, he was a man getting mental health services, which meant it was probably significantly less comfortable. Or he wasn't, and these guys just wanted money. It doesn't matter. He was murdered, and that's not okay. And regardless of whether or not you want to fit this crime as a definition for a hate crime, they happen a lot, and it's not okay. We still have the gay panic defense on the fucking books. I can't with that one. I can't go there right now. And that's the thing. It's fucked up. And both are true and right in their own value. And yes, if Matt was killed because of drugs, that's not a hate crime. But in my opinion, because Aaron McKinney has no problem throwing that slur around, and he has no problem telling people that he did it to teach him a lesson to be less outwardly gay, that hatred is there, which played a role in the motivation, which to me makes it a hate crime. But
and that they pretended to be gay to get him to go with them, yeah, to do, you know, that
there's some element of trickiness there. Yeah,
which was that a tactic to get him alone and it wasn't a gay motivated thing? Or was that, you know, that, to me, right, that could go either way. But I think coupled with all of the other evidence.
Yes. That, and like, I think a lot of my purpose in pointing this out is not because I truly care about the classification of this crime, which is a weird thing to say after spending so long defending it. I do, mm-hmm, believe that. But ultimately, I think what I'm trying to get people to take away from this is that it doesn't matter what the rationale was. The murder was wrong. And if it at all had anything to do with him being gay, then the results that came afterwards, the cultural response, the legislative response was good. And it wasn't for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
There's an article that came out that said something like Matt Shepard was no angel. Nobody is an angel. We're people. We're, mm-hmm, humans. We're flawed. That's the problem with deifying victims like this to an unhealthy extent.
Absolutely.
You know, the higher the pedestal, the higher the fall. But he didn't put himself there. And people put him there, I think, to raise awareness for hate and the unsafe nature of being gay in culture at that time.
I'm sure if you could ask Matt, he'd much rather be off the pedestal and still alive than on the pedestal and
because have either what way, happened to him. He's getting attacked, right? But if he's alive, he can do something positive that he chose to do with it, which is the other reason I say this was not a sacrifice. People say that, you know, what Matt sacrificed was for so many other greater goods, and that's not right either. He didn't do that for you. He didn't do that for me. He didn't do that. That was done to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of why I want to shake everyone. Like, people that are so far in either direction, I'm like, stop. Like, he was a boy. He was a man. And this happened to him and it wasn't okay. And we need to look at the greater trends of this happening that aren't okay. And separately from each other and together, they're not okay. But that doesn't mean that your narrative is the right one. And it's just, I just wish people would look at things with a little more nuance, but I guess we are not quite there yet.
I think at its core, it's a matter of luring somebody away, robbing them, beating the ever-loving shit out of them, and abandoning them to die alone in a field.
Yep.
Is something that if you saw in a movie, you'd probably turn it off and say, all right, enough.
We've gone too far.
You know, that's, come on now. I got to be able to sleep. I got to be able to eat dinner.
And then you leave and beat another fucking guy.
Like that. So whatever, at this point, regardless of what the motive was, whether they didn't like his shoes, whether they wanted his shoes, whether it was because he was gay, whether it was because he wasn't gay, whatever it was, they did horrendous things to another person and lured him away for needless reasons. The added aspect of it being something that doesn't matter.
Yep. But I wanted to say before I end this that Matt is not alone. He wasn't alone in his life and his struggles or his death. He wasn't alone in his impact, and he's not alone in his mental health. I'm taking stats from the Trevor Project, but 41% of young queer people seriously contemplated taking their own lives last year. Mm-hmm. Of those 41%, young people who identified as queer and have identified being teased, bullied, threatened, or in otherwise pestered for it, attempted suicide at triple the rate of their other queer peers. Matt had lived not only with the normal mental health that anyone does, but the higher rates of being a gay man. I'm sure he was picked on before the incident. And then, of course, with Morocco, he had more complications with his mental health. But then, with all of the other assaults that he had, that heightened his risk even more. Matt was living in a world where if these two asshats didn't brutally kill him, people's discreet, open, and legislative hatred might have killed him anyways. And that's the shit of it. So I don't believe that Matt made a sacrifice, and I will appreciate what his death did for queer equality, but we still have so far to go. You can read more about the current impact at the Trevor Project, and further, and I would hope that you do, if anything, if you want to support causes near and dear to Matt and his family, check out the Matthew Shepherd Foundation. His mom and dad started it afterwards and have dedicated the rest of their life to making an impact for queer people to have a safe place, but also all kids to have a safe place.
Oh, we'll have that linked in our Instagram as well under our resources.
If you feel like you need to do more, you can vote, speak up when people are being bullied, hurt, picked on, or threatened due to their sexuality. But I want to end with a different call to action. I told you all the story of Matthew Shepherd's death and the glorious sentencing of his two offenders, but I didn't tell you who Matt was. I can't really. I wasn't there. I don't know his family personally, but I have two hopes for you, dear listener. Please go watch the movie Matthew Shepherd is a Friend of Mine. It was made by his dear friend Michelle from his Switzerland boarding school, and it will show you much more of Matt than I ever could. If you want extra credit, go listen to that You're Wrong About episode. I think they do a great job talking about journalistic integrity, talking about ways to interpret new updates on crimes that I think are really interesting, and also just talking about, you know, the complications of having to talk about trends in anecdotal evidence and stories. And they have the luxury of doing about this amount of time on it, but that topic alone, so they get a lot deeper into it than I could. You can see both for free. We'll link both, but I watched the documentary on Tubi. You can also rent it off of Amazon for like 99 cents.
All right.
But lastly, just a reminder of who we're talking about today, because Matt deserves to be honored. Matt Shepard was artistic. He was sweet. He was sensitive and kind. He was the kind of guy that made you feel heard and someone you wanted to hear. He was messy and dramatic and traumatized and anxious, insecure and afraid. He was smart. He was daring. He was caring, and he was a friend. And he was a man who would have changed the world. He wanted to become famous, and he wanted to make an impact for people, and he did both, even if it wasn't how he expected. His family carries on his legacy, and I hope you will too. And that was the tragic death, the tragic murder of Matthew Shepard.
I don't have words.
They're gone.
My stomach hurts.
Yeah, mine does too. What a world.
We're going to have so many resources linked.
So many resources.
So many resources linked for you guys.
Let us know how you feel. Be respectful, because I simply won't be handling anything that isn't.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, give us your take. Did this impact you? Were you alive for it? Do you remember it? What do you remember? Tell me.
Send us an email. Let us know your thoughts on this episode, other ones you've heard before. If you liked what you heard today, or you've liked what you've heard in the past, or both, we'd love that. And you want to hear more of it, don't forget to follow the pod and rate, review, tell a friend, tell a foe. Five stars is always, you know, what we recommend. If you could do six, we'd say that too, but of course we're biased. But
if you're on Spotify, you can comment on the episode if you scroll down,
which we love. We love seeing those.
We are obsessed with them. And Spotify just recently let us start liking them. So we will be liking them. Thank you.
Just saying.
And other than that, if you wanted to see Matt, which I heavily recommend because he's such a stinking cutie, or his family, the people, the places, the things that we talk about, and of course get to those resources like the Matthew Shepard Foundation and Trevor Project, you could do that on our Instagram. But you would do that by searching in that little search bubble, About Time for True Crime Pod, with periods in between every word. So that is ABOUT period, TIME period, FOR period, TRUE period, CRIME period, POD, because podcast was too long. But if you, much like podcast, want to send us something a little too long, you could do that to our email. Allie, where would they email that?
If you wanted to send us an email, you could do that to abouttime4tc@gmail.com. So that's abouttime4tc@gmail.com.
All right. Thanks so much, you guys. I have no better words, but we love you. We can't wait to see you next week. If I look at my clock, that was
About Time for True Crime.
Bye.
Jinx.